Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories.
Don't warn that tyranny is always lurking just around the corner.
Conspiracy theories.
You should reject these voices.
You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
But I want to say one thing to the American people.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again.
They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all.
Outrageous conspiracy theories.
You should reject these voices.
I want to say this to the television.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Beard World Order. I am your co-host, Guillermo Jimenez of TracesOfReality.com, joined as always by James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. And on today's show, we've got a special guest with us, Mr. Pierce Redman of Pierce Policy Radio. PiercePolicyReview.wordpress.com is the website. Pierce, did I get the website right? And how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. It's actually Porkins
Policy. Porkins Policy Review. That's what I meant to say. Didn't I say that?
Pierce Policy Review.
We're doing that again. I'm telling you.
Okay.
No, we're actually not.
You're my first guest on the show.
And we're off to a flying start.
Yeah, this is a great start so far. Porkins Policy Radio. Pierce Redman is the man who's with us today.
Yeah.
James, how are you doing this morning?
Go ahead. The website is Porkins Policy Review.
PorkinsPolicyReview.wordpress.com. Excellent.
Yeah, I know. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, but it's rather longish, but yeah.
I know. Yeah, I'm kind of stuck with it now. I don't think I can switch it.
No. Gone too far.
Yeah. Yeah.
James, yourself, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, but actually, I'm kind of jealous of Guillermo Jimenez, so maybe you can just call me James Corbet or something. You know, a little bit of flair to it.
With the soft J, yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. That sounds good. We'll do that, maybe. I wouldn't be surprised if that sticks, perhaps. Well, anyway, so on today's show, what we'll be discussing is, I guess I'll just throw it out there, we're discussing the potential for a possible World War III type scenario, right? And I'll let James sort of set this up for the audience, but I'll open this up with a quick tweet that I came across the other day by Charlie Skelton, actually. You guys out there might know him from his coverage of the Bilderberg Group. They call him the Guardian Charlie or something like that, right? So I found it rather humorous. So it says, "I find it particularly touching that we're commemorating the start of World War I by starting World War III." And that I think sums up what we're going to be talking about here today in a way. So, James, if you wouldn't mind kind of introducing the topic here for our audience.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think we're exactly plucking this out of left field. I don't think this is going to come as a big shock to anyone. As Charlie's making fun of there, I mean, I think we've all heard by now the sort of, you know, isn't it ironic, 100 years after World War I, it looks like we're heading to World War III. And again, this is part of the zeitgeist. Not the video series, of course, the good German meaning of that, the time spirit that we're living in. U.S. Wants World War III because its big banks are insolvent, claims Press TV. And NBC News counters with former Ukrainian interim PM Yatsenyuk, who said Russia wants to start World War III. Mail Online has an article, Edward Lucas, "I hope I'm wrong, but historians may look back and say this was the start of World War III." We have LaRouche Pack that has an entire page up on Stop World War III. We have a post from Global Research, Professor Chosadovsky, Ukraine, the worst case scenario is World War III. Again, this has been kicked around quite a bit of late, so I don't think, again, we're going out on a limb with it. But I guess what I'd like to drill down on today is a couple of topics. I mean, first of all, how likely is World War III, really? I mean, do you see this actually eventuating, or is this part of a different agenda? Is there something else that we're looking at? Are we looking at more of some sort of Cold War scenario? Is this likely to turn hot? And then I guess the other question would be, well, then if it is heading to World War III, what is the flashpoint? What are the battle lines? What would it look like? So a lot to delve into, a lot of meat to sink our teeth into. And I guess since this is, Pierce, it's your first time here on the Beard World Order, why don't we just put you straight on the hot plate? Give us your take. What do you think? World War III, yay, nay, soon, later, never? What's your take on what's happening right now?
I don't know. I think we'll probably find that we kind of all, I would think that all three of us would probably have a similar view in that it seems almost inevitable with all of the sort of buildup that's going on around the world You can look at the encircling of Russia. You can look at the current crisis in the Middle East right now, be it Syria or Iraq or, you know, name, pick a country. So it does seem that we are, you know, arriving at some sort of catastrophic World War III scenario. But at the same time, I think there's also, as you said, there's a lot of hype around this. And I'm a little bit torn between the two, because it does seem that, what is NATO doing if this isn't preparing for some sort of all-out global war? Then indeed, why are they, you know, constantly building up? Why is everybody and their mother talking about how, you know, Russia is going to, you know, march on the United States or, you know, whatever the crazy scenario is. But at the same time, I think that there is also, I think as we'll explore, other agendas that get pushed during times of war. And that might be more of what's really going on. But yeah, on some level, I hate to say it, but I think that some sort of war will be inevitable, because there's just simply no way that America and NATO and the Western forces and what have you can continue on this path without somebody sort of stepping up and saying, well, enough is enough. You're not going any farther than this. And we kind of see that very much in Ukraine. You know, I don't know what the end game solution is there, but it does seem that on some level this could be some kind of military confrontation between Russia and the Western powers.
Indeed. Well, you know, I see what both of you are saying here. And before I forget, I want to mention just one quick article also, that since, James, you were running through a few of these that are kind of putting this sort of this idea out there. And again, like you said, this is nothing new. It's been kicked around for a while now. But I did want to mention this quick article that I came across the other day that I found relevant to what we're talking about. It's out of washingtonsblog.com. It says, the headline is, "Top Financial Experts Say World War III is Coming Unless We Stop It." And it's a collection of different statements from, as the headline says, financial experts from mainly the United States, talking about the potential for a world war or some kind of war, some kind of conflict as a result of the economy, as a result of the world's finances. So that's something also that's worth paying attention to, what these guys are saying. But I guess when I first heard the topic suggested by you, James, and I was thinking about this a little bit yesterday. Sort of thinking, you know, as far as a World War III type scenario, well, I will agree that certainly things are shaping out for some sort of confrontation. It seems to be headed in that direction. As you said, Pierce, I mean, why else would NATO be doing what they're doing unless they're preparing for some sort of confrontation? However, when I think of a World War III type scenario, of course, you know, I have to go back to what we know from history through World War I and World War II. And I guess my question is, like, I'll throw this back, because I don't know how, if ever, we'll see a war on that scale, on that dynamic. Because, you know, as we know, this is not breaking news. I'm not telling anyone anything they don't already know, but the U.S. has not officially declared war since World War II. We just don't go to war in this way anymore. And I don't see why the United States ever would again. Why would they defer to Congress and officially declare war and go through the Treasury and go through all that hoopla when we can just have these low-intensity conflicts and keep that going? Seems to be working pretty well for the American empire anyway so far, so why rock the boat? You know what I mean? But I agree that there's something brewing. I just don't know if we'll ever see another world war in the sort of classic sense, and I want to get James's opinion on that.
Well, then let me kick back on what you said and agree with you. I mean, the question of why would it be different? Why would they do something different than what they've been doing for the past 70 years? I think it's ultimately not going to be their choice. I mean, sure, I think if the U.S. had their druthers, I don't know how to say that in regular, they would obviously just keep doing what they're doing, because it's obviously worked out quite well for them throughout this whole Pax Americana period. A complete misnomer, by the way, because of course it's not a time of peace. It's a time of constant low-level intensity conflicts that they get to sort of sweep under the rug and not make. Of course, it's not called war because they don't declare war, etc., as you say. But I think ultimately that the idea of the Third World War is that eventually there will be a force that will push back against that and that will force the issue to a head. So I think that would be the response to that. But I agree with you very much so that I don't, I mean, the Second World War didn't look like the First World War. The First World War was a trench war that that was along certain lines that were carved out very early in the conflict. The Second World War was much more dynamic. The Third World War, I just can't imagine how that would play out, right, given the weaponry that's available now, in some sort of years-long protracted battle between major superpowers. I just don't understand how such a war would really work in that context, which is why I think the old adage, there's an old military adage that the military planners are always planning for the last war. Mm-hmm. I think the public also is kind of caught in that mentality, that we still think of war as we've grown up with it all our lives, watching the documentaries about World War II or what have you. We look at that, and that's what war looks like. That's what war is. I think we've entered into a completely different era in which war does not look like that, and it will not look like that if it does actually come to that point. I think what we are more likely to see is exactly as the Washington's blog article you're talking about there indicates with the financial experts, it is going to be more of an economic conflict. I think that there is going to be economic war waged. I think it's already starting to be waged, but I think that's going to take on a different form and a more... it's going to come more to a head. And I don't claim to understand exactly how this is going to work, but I do think that it is going to be more in an economic arena than it is necessarily on a battlefield. That will involve all sorts of other peripheral ideas there, like cyber warfare and things of that nature, trying to disrupt financial infrastructure and things along those lines. I just don't know, you know... again, if someone pushes the button and starts the nukes flying, then I think all bets are off the table, and I think that's what we all want to avoid. But I could imagine some sort of economic conflict eventuating from this, and I think along those lines, probably the most significant step along the path that we've seen recently is the food import sanctions that were just placed last week by Russia. I think that was a huge escalation of what's going on, because we have lived through this era where the American Empire has been able to assert its will unilaterally for so long and with so little kickback that they can impose their sanctions, they can basically dictate reality to the outside world. Along comes Russia and Putin, and they actually try to flip the table. They try to actually kick back with sanctions that are... they're not exactly going to end the economic world as we know it, but there are significant sanctions. We're talking about billions of dollars in terms of the agricultural industries in Europe, in Canada, in the United States, in Australia. These are significant sanctions that will have an effect. So I think that we're starting to see what an economic tit-for-tat skirmish looks like in the build-up to a potential war. But having said all of that, again, at a certain point, I don't know how an economic war doesn't spill into some sort of military conflict or how that would be avoided. So I guess all I can say is my thinking on this subject is still quite muddied. Pierce, clear the waters for us.
Well, I think maybe it's important, as you were saying, you know, a general is always prepare for the last war. I think it's important to maybe come at the idea of World War III from a different angle and to perhaps think more broadly that we're already in multiple world wars, be it the war on terror or the war on drugs, where we virtually, I mean, the war on drugs, I mean, affects literally every single person on the planet and is, you know, as far reaching as you can imagine. The same with the war on terror. So these world wars are already going on. And a lot of time I see the World War III example as this sort of distraction issue that shifts attention away from the fact that we're in a perpetual war. You can, you know, people will talk about World War III and, oh my God, Russia's going to nuke us and we're going to have to nuke Russia. And while that goes on, you know, the Obama starts bombing Iraq again with absolutely no protest or I mean, really even anything. I mean, not even in the alternative media, there's such apathy, I think, towards this perpetual war state that it kind of happens. And it's, you know, the articles you see are very like, you know, oh, phew, what a surprise, you know.
Here we go again, you know, right. Bombing.
Yeah, exactly. So I think a lot of time this you know, World War III stuff is, it needs to be seen in a different context. But again, I don't know. I think, you know, there's some part of me in the back of my head that sort of sees that as you were saying, with the stuff with Russia right now, I mean, you know, you've got countries in Europe, like Poland and some other places, that are really terrified. Because, you know, if you cut Apple imports from Poland, suddenly you have millions of people out of a job. So now, how does Poland react? And that sort of it sort of translates into a lot of these sort of entangling alliances and some of the echoes of World War One. But when you have all these countries that are so interdependent on one another, you do get to a point where this economic warfare will reach a point where I don't really, I don't think there's another option that will be on the table aside from some sort of military action. If these economic sanctions with Russia get to a certain point, I mean, what other choice do they really have? And again, with these economic sanctions, we see the line sort of being drawn. We're now, you know, we get countries like Belarus and, some of the other countries in Russia's sphere of influence, upping their imports. And we can kind of see the battle lines being drawn there. So, I mean, what does that say? I'm not really sure exactly. But again, I think while we shouldn't obsess over World War III, I don't know. On some level, I don't really see where is this military buildup going. You know, and it's not just Russia. I mean, look at China. Look at the Senkaku Islands. James, that's very close to you, and I don't think that's going to start World War III. But again, what happens if China takes one of these islands by force? What does Japan or America really do? Do they, go in there by force? What is that? How does that escalate from there? So it is troubling, and I think that's also part of this whole thing, is to keep everyone on edge, to keep everyone in a perpetual state of fear that at any moment World War III could start, when of course this helps to, sort of put the blinders up on people from seeing the, war that's going on literally all over the planet. So I don't know. I think we're going to probably see a lot of this.
Yeah, and I wanted to suggest quickly that as you initially started talking about this, Pierce, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say that we are already in a sort of World War III-like scenario. If you think of it in a different way, as you said, James, something you said actually really struck me, because I think we do have to think about the way we think about war, the way we define war now in the modern era, because as you said, it's definitely not going to look like World War I and World War II. And in that sense, World War III has already begun. As you said, America, at least, is at war in multiple continents. It's, I guess, in a way, at war with Russia by proxy, right? In Syria, the Ukraine, and some would argue in Latin America. Although I take a slightly different view there, I think, but I've seen that argument made. And so I guess what we're really asking is whether we're going to see an escalation, if we're going to see an overt military confrontation between the United States and Russia specifically. That's, I think, what we're really driving at, is that going to happen? Are we going to have an all-out nuclear war as a result of that? And I would certainly hope not, of course, but yeah, I think I would agree with both of you so far that I think that war has already begun. Now we're just really asking about a matter of degree.
Right. Yeah. A matter of degree, a matter of the way in which this will be waged, the way that it's distraction from other issues, as Pierce says. I agree with what you're saying, but I guess the question then is sort of a question of the battle lines. I mean, if we are being drawn into some sort of conflict, again, however it eventuates and whether or not we can call it World War III or whatever. But clearly battle lines are being drawn right now. And I think that the obvious battle lines that people would say as a first approximation would be something like, the BRICS versus NATO or something along those lines. We kind of see those kind of battle lines drawn. And of course, the BRICS Development Bank is a battle against the Washington Consensus and these types of challenges that are being posed right now. And it seems, Russia and China are clearly being encircled by NATO. So they have a common kind of enemy there that makes them kind of drives them into each other's arms, etc. That's, I think, would be the conventional assessment of what we're looking at. But Pierce, what you just said, for example, pointing out Poland, for example, and the kind of tight position that they're in, given that, certain sanctions implied in the right way by Russia could completely devastate some of their agricultural industry. Or, I mean, look at South Stream and the different kinds of wrangling that's been going on there in Eastern Europe, with some of the Eastern European nations being bristling quite a bit at Brussels, trying to tell them, you know, don't do business with Russia. Well, hey, it would do really good for our country. I think there are some interesting divisions going on that might complicate that BRICS-NATO kind of battle line narrative. And I want to explore some of that. And one of the interesting things that I came across just as I was sort of researching for today's conversation, China's nuclear parasol. So the diplomat was reporting on a Washington Times report from December of last year in which China was giving security guarantees to Ukraine back when Yanukovych was in power, not only pledging not to use nuclear arms against Ukraine, which I'm not sure why China would be doing that in the first place, but also to actually pledge security if Ukraine were to Ukraine's territorial integrity were to be violated by any sort of nuclear invasion, quote unquote nuclear invasion, China would step in, which is, I mean, bizarre and also brings with it all sorts of questions about China and its role and whether it really is an ally of Russia or it's just kind of, you know, driven into their arms by convenience, but they're not necessarily partners. And there's a lot of things to complicate that very straightforward narrative that sometimes is drawn. Pierce, what's your take on what the battle lines of that we're seeing drawn really are?
Yeah, I think that you're correct to pick up on this because it doesn't seem as clear cut as the mainstream media would have us believe. And it's certainly nothing like World War II or World War I, where essentially, you know, you had pretty identifiable groups that were fighting one another. I think it also I don't really buy this China-Russia, friendship. I think that they, historically speaking, they've always been sort of uneasy with one another. And this is, you know, forever. I mean, since, 60s, 70s, it doesn't really matter at any point. And China essentially has always been about protecting China. And, the Chinese people, the Chinese government has, they've always sort of, wanted to separate themselves from others. They've never wanted to be colonized by anybody. So I don't think that this Russia-China thing is more than a sort of, tacit agreement that, let's sort of support one another in things like the UN or perhaps somewhat in economic issues, let's have a little bit of a buddy. But when push comes to shove, I don't think that if there was some war was to break out between the United States and Russia, let's say, I don't think that China would come in and back the Russians.
Let me elaborate on that, because I think the interesting part of the China-Ukraine thing going on there is the fact that China is very concerned, always concerned about territorial integrity and don't interfere with other people's, territory and things. Of course, Russia has a very different perspective on Ukraine and what's happening there and sees Ukraine as its sort of traditional backyard territory. So it's kind of Russian space or in that orbit. And Russia has, at the very least, there is that old kind of Soviet mentality that there is this kind of satellite around Russia that's kind of part of Russian politics, which is a very different idea than what China is going on. China is all about, these are the borders and no one messes with the borders. So they have points at which I think they would very much disagree. And I think we saw some of that in the Syrian conflict as well, with China, again, being very, very wary about some of the interventionary moves that were being made, even by Russia and trying to protect the Russian interests in Syria. China is more all about the hands off. So I think that's at least a potential point at which that comes to a head.
Yeah, and I absolutely, and we've seen that in other things too. I mean, China backs Sudan, but I don't think that they would necessarily send troops in if the United States invaded. And you're talking about Sudan probably being the closest African country with China. But I can't really imagine that. Now they'll talk up the rhetoric, of course, but. Going back to the what are the battle lines, I'm not really sure exactly because, I was sort of thinking about this, I was trying to think a little bit with World War I, the anniversary of that, and sort of relating what would be, because, you know, you're hearing all these academics talking about, oh, you know, it's similar, but not really. It's not going to happen. You know, we don't need to worry, but oh my God, Russia. But, you know, a conflict that is in some ways is kind of similar could be what's going on right now in between Azerbaijan and Armenia in the Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a little breakaway region. And this in some ways kind of relates with the, say, the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, in that you have you know, the assassination of Franz Ferdinand and Serbia, and, you know, you could ask virtually anyone and they'll tell you, oh yeah, right, that's what started World War One. But there's, you know, absolutely no context to what the Serbian nationalist movement meant, what Franz Ferdinand meant to anybody. You know, more people are familiar with the band than they are with the person that he's, you know, they're named after. And, you know, with this breakaway region, I see that as kind of, you know, something similar in that Armenia is backed by Russia. Azerbaijan is very much backed by the United States. And some kind of issue between the two of them, that could escalate into a larger kind of scale problem. And it, you know, would be in a region that virtually no one knows about, no one would understand. But suddenly, you know, we would hear these talks about, you know, Russians butchering the Azerbaijan, and, you know, United States butchering Armenians, and oh my God, another genocide there, you know, God forbid, and you've got gas and oil pipelines. But to even expand on that more, you know, Russia sells a lot to Azerbaijan. So again, I don't think there's any clear-cut sort of battle lines drawn between the two. And on a further note, I don't think that that's going to happen anytime soon. A lot of this is hype to get international attention. But that is a sort of situation, I think, again, thinking outside the box, that is the kind of situation that could spark a World War III. Not necessarily Ukraine. I do think that, you know, Europe does not want to see another massive war that's going to, you know, I mean, World War I especially, I mean, you're talking about wiping out millions and millions of people in a very short period of time. Brutal, brutal things. Europe doesn't want something like that again. But some sort of low-intensity war or some sort of small proxy war in a Central Asian country where we don't really know anything and we can kind of do whatever, you know, that could be something. But again, even those battle lines are not very clear-cut, because I don't really know, you know, would Russia really want to get involved? So I'm not really sure what the battle lines would be. And I think, again, it would be more proxy based. I don't think we're going to see formal troops really fighting one another. And, you know, that is sort of the kind of go-to protocol all over the world right now. So, you know, of course, we're involved in Africa, we're involved in Central Asia, but not in any, you know, formal sense where we've got battalions or we've got conventional warfare going on. But, you know, I know that's a whole big can of worms I just opened up there. So I'll throw it back to you guys.
No, and it's very, very interesting, especially as you guys are talking about the dynamic between Russia and China and whether and what's really going on beneath the surface. Because, again, superficially, they have many of the same shared economic interests. And I wanted to throw in another dynamic to this conversation. We focus mainly so far on the Eastern Hemisphere. I wanted to throw in the Western Hemisphere a little bit, because I had a conversation about this on the last 2 Hour Radio, which is not yet published, but it will be soon. But with a friend of mine, and we're talking about how on the Eastern Hemisphere, this new Cold War, as you said, James, is heating up. You know, we have, you know, these low intensity conflicts happening right now, but on the Western Hemisphere, we have Russia and China, again, at least superficially, with mutually shared economic interests in Latin America. We had Putin and Xi Jinping recently tour Latin America and go through the various, they visited the BRICS summit, of course, and we had Colombia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Argentina entering into economic agreements with Russia and China both. There's this new Nicaraguan canal being built to compete with the Panama Canal, which I found really interesting. I saw some notes about this that they're citing that the canal will be wide enough to possibly have Russian naval ships pass through. And they mentioned this because, coincidentally, Nicaragua is scheduled to host a Russian resupply base sometime in the near future, they swear that they will not be they will not have actual ships stationed at this. It'll just be a resupply station. But anyway, so I wanted to throw this dynamic out there because, again, so far this has remained very much a cold sort of posturing sort of thing on this Western Hemisphere, Latin America mainly. And I wanted to get a sense from you guys what you think about this potentially becoming more of what we see on the eastern side of the world. Is that a potential? Does that strike anyone as a potentiality, or will they remain simply, beating their chests and posturing in the way that they are?
Well, I would say, there certainly is a sense at which this may be of a piece. And as you gesture there towards Nicaragua and Russia and some of the ties there, there have been people talking. For example, I just saw that with regards to these sanctions that Russia has just imposed on Europe and America and Australia, the food import sanctions, the European Union is lobbying in Latin America to get the governments not to rush in and take their place and start selling to Russia to, may take advantage of this. So, there's definitely some interesting geopolitical things that are now really starting to span across the globe and reach across the ocean there that, EU, Latin American geopolitical relations as they relate to Russia is not something that we would have really been thinking right. about just even a few short years ago. So it is becoming part of a piece. And that, I think, again, adds at least some credence to the idea that this is shaping into a world war in the sense that we've been trained to think about that, that truly, Latin America will be an important part of that. And of course, it's explicitly there in the BRICS relation, obviously with Brazil playing a key part in that grouping. So I don't know specifically about the tensions within Latin America. That's obviously your expertise more so than mine. But I think it certainly can be seen to be playing a piece in the sort of broader battle lines.
Well, I think that as Russia say gets more involved, or China especially, I think that's the real thing. When China gets involved, that's when we start to see. Various mysterious, vague, terrorist movements such as Al-Shabaab in Kenya, and this recent spike of violence in Kenya supposedly being perpetrated by Al-Shabaab with all sorts of nefarious characters like Samantha Luthwaite allegedly being involved in literally everything that goes on there. This all comes on the back of China's billion-dollar investment in the country. So that canal that China is going to help build, I would not be surprised if all of a sudden we see some sort of quote indigenous group or some sort of freedom fighters or just straight up terrorists sprouting out of nowhere with. Brand new Jeeps and AK-47s and nice uniforms, and they've got a great social media presence and whatnot. That's the kind of world war scenario that we're going to see, and I think we're starting to see the fruition of that in Iraq, where after all of these years, we've now finally reached the point where it is mission accomplished. In that, the country will never ever pick itself up again. And this latest ISIL, artist formerly known as IS, whatever, you want to call it, that is sort of the playbook, and we're starting to see the beginning of that right now in Africa, where virtually every place that China is involved, we're seeing these groups start to sprout up, and they're becoming more and more powerful. They're having a larger and larger presence. So I think Xinjiang in China, the same thing. These very well, seemingly well organized groups that are able to stab and kill 100 people in broad daylight. And then seemingly kind of, escape or it doesn't even matter. And that's the kind of war that I think we're going to see. And I don't want to make predictions, but that the canal in Nicaragua, don't be surprised if we get some strange group popping up and, blowing up some building near a Chinese facility.
That's
right.
A very,
well,
a
well, at any rate,
fact.
Those are the kinds of things we're already seeing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, those are the kind of Gladio operations that have been going on for a while and will presumably continue to do so as long as it continues to benefit the people who are looking to destabilize some of those strategic regions. But I think that your point earlier on was well taken, that that it probably, the flashpoint probably will not be the one that everyone's looking at, Ukraine. It'll probably be somewhere else, something somewhat peripheral, if and when this actually does. I mean, if there is a point at which this spills over into crisis, it will probably come in some area where people aren't necessarily focused on, or at least not so much so. And obviously, I'm in the Asia Pacific, so I see all of these different squabbles that are taking place right now between China and basically everyone else. And then some of the internal squabbles, I mean, Japan and Korea also squabble with each other and all of these things. So, and of course, North Korea, the big wild card. So there's all sorts of different places where this could happen out here. And of course, that brings in America with its pledges, security pledges. And we could see something kicking off here. As you say, it could happen in Central Asia. It could happen in Africa. It could happen pretty much anywhere. So, so really, truly global. But let's kick this conversation up a notch. Here on the Beard World Order, in recent conversations, we've talked a lot about conspiracies and meta-conspiracies. Well, what about the meta-conspiracy to start a world war, or to stage a world war, or to use a world war as a springboard to a greater agenda? And I think we can... it's something I often point out. I mean, obviously, after the First World War, what was the real offshoot of that? Well, of course, there was the Versailles and the Paris Peace Accords, or the Paris Conference, and of course, carving up the world into the world that we now know it as, and basically drawing all the lines on the map that we now know. So that was pretty significant. At the end of the Second World War, of course, we get the United Nations, we get the IMF and what eventually became the World Bank, the kind of financial world infrastructure that we've known for the last 70 years. So what would develop from the Third World War? And obviously, I think that the same forces that have used every major conflict to try to drive the agenda of global government closer to home will undoubtedly use the Third World War for such a scenario if that takes place. Now, we could bring in things like, and I think we should at least mention it, Albert Pike's letter to Mazzini back in 1871, quote, "The Third World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences caused by the agentur of the Illuminati between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. The war must be conducted in such a way that Islam, the Muslim Arabic world, and political Zionism, the State of Israel, mutually destroy each other. Meanwhile, the other nations, once more divided on the issue, will be constrained to fight to the point of complete physical, moral, spiritual, and economical exhaustion. We shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists, and we shall provoke a formidable social cataclysm which in all its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism, origin of savagery, and of the most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere the citizens, obliged to defend themselves against the world minority of revolutionaries, will exterminate those destroyers of civilization, and the multitude, disillusioned with Christianity, whose deistic spirits from that moment be without compass or direction, anxious for an ideal, but without knowing where to render its adoration, will receive the true light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer, brought finally out in the public view. This manifestation will result from the general reactionary movement which will follow the destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." End quote.
Nailed
this
it.
This is a much quoted letter, again, supposedly written in 1871. There are all sorts of questions about this letter in all sorts of different ways, but my point would be, I'll believe it when I actually see it. I don't believe this letter exists, and I don't believe anything that what it's talking about. But at the very least, the idea that such a conflict could be created as a springboard towards a greater agenda is one that I think needs to be taken seriously. And on that note, I'm currently reading Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War, which puts forward the case about the First World War being created by British interests, specifically around the Rhodes Roundtable group, and how they fomented the First World War consciously and purposefully. And I think that would tie into the testimony of Norman Dodd, looking at the archives of the Carnegie Endowment and how they were consciously trying to steer the United States into war from their foundation in 1908. I think that there are interests in seeing war fomented and used as a political tool Indeed. For changing society. So let's get your thoughts on that. First, you can, of course, if you want to convince me that Pike actually did write that letter, please go ahead. Or otherwise, what you think the ultimate effect of a war might be in the longer term, the bigger agenda.
You know, I have to confess that I was not familiar with that letter until you just read it, James. But I wanted to just mention something quickly, because on that note, on the note of the conspiracy to create conflict, I was actually going to ask you guys something before you posed that question, James, which is, I think it relates. So it's, I'm not going to, you know, monopolize the conversation. I'm going to, you know, it's connected. Just follow me here for a second. Something that Pierce brought up actually reminded me of this. And that, again, on the notion of creating conflict or a conspiracy to create conflict, I was going to ask you guys what you guys think of the role of social media in World War III. And I'm not kidding. I know that might sound a little ridiculous, but in the sense of, you know, again, and fomenting conflict in the digital age. Because another story that I had my attention on recently was the story that the AP broke about USAID and Cuba, basically up to their old tricks, as usual, recruiting, sending activists from other parts of Latin America into Cuba to recruit other activists to foment, you know, dissent, you know that sort of stuff. But they were propping up these fake HIV prevention workshops, basically, and going around posing as tourists. But again, yeah, same old stuff. And also curiously wondering why this sort of stuff continues to be tried over and over and over again and fail, and yet we have USAID and places like Ukraine successfully orchestrating a coup. So just a interesting dynamic there. But anyway, on that note again, so, you know, yeah, so I agree with you, James, completely that these sorts of things can be created for larger ends. And I'm curious about how that would happen. And I think that would probably play a role. And also, I forget, sorry, the story that I was originally going to mention was the first AP story in which the USA created that Cuban Twitter program. That's how social media ties in. Realized how I did not make that connection, and many people were probably confused, like, what the hell is this guy talking about? That's the story that I was originally going to bring up. The Cuban Twitter, Zunzuneo, and looking up activists via Twitter or this fake Twitter program. Something like this may have happened. It's been speculated. I don't have the articles in front of me at the moment. That may have happened during the Arab Spring, through the use of sock puppets, these so-called Twitter revolutions, things like this. So anyway, wanted to throw that out there and see if we can sort of make that connection between how it would happen and what the result would be. So I'll throw it to Pierce.
Oh yeah, I think social media is becoming more and more the catalyst for all of these sort of things. So you know, you put a hashtag and you say, you know, bring back our girls in Nigeria, or bring back our boys in Israel, and suddenly then you can go and slaughter as many people as you want, or push whatever kind of ridiculous legislation through. And of course, I think, you know, and then you get all of these, you know, people like the Google executive, whose name is escaping me right now, in Egypt, and his sort of shady connections with, you know, Google and other things. And I think the social media aspect of this also kind of brings in the, you know, if we want to get kind of meta and larger, but the whole transhumanist, the whole technology kind of agenda behind so much of war. And you know, you can look at the sort of the idea that's been put forth by a couple people, but Thomas Sheridan has been talking about this for a while in anticipation of World War I. But you know, this idea that, you know, World War I essentially being orchestrated by a bunch of heads of royalty, of European royalty, who are all related to one another. You know, they're all related to the Queen of England, and you've got the Tsar, you've got the Kaiser, you've got the Queen of Romania, all of these countries, and then they sort of, you know, they technologically advance everything to this point that, you know, it's almost, you know, people didn't really even recognize what this kind of warfare was like. And then suddenly you depopulate all of Europe at a time when many of these countries were very stressed economically, that, you know, they can't provide for all of these working class dregs and whatnot. And then you just kind of wipe out the whole population, and then you and then technology kind of flourishes again. You get the telegraph, you get all sorts of things kind of manifesting, and this melding between technology and people kind of going on. And I think that
the
we see that
the telegraph.
I think right? No, am I wrong?
That was 19th century.
Well, there we go. I am confusing that with maybe I've thought of the something else, but some kind of mass communication. No,
I suppose radio was coming into its own around the time. Yeah,
there we go. That's what I meant. Totally. But anyway, back to that kind of again, you get, and now we see that somewhat here, where people live in their phones. They're tweeting about World War III constantly. They're able to kind of foment change, and I think that's really what World War III would kind of take on again. This depopulation, that there's too many people, and what a wonderful way to get rid of so many of them through some sort of warfare. And again, we're seeing you could just go to DARPA's website, and I mean, they really are molding people and machines into soldiers. And this is kind of the next level and the next stage of all of this. And then, again, the whole GMO agenda, Monsanto, all these groups that are kind of interconnected with one another, and, biowarfare as a new sort of frontier. So that's sort of a long-winded explanation. But I think that, if we want to get really meta, I think that's really the kind of way we're getting pushed, and and again that enters so many occult ideas and weird traditions that kind of connect with transhumanism and connect with World War One as well.
That's an excellent point. Let's stay on that for a little, because certainly the technological aspect of this is important, because obviously the First World War, I mean, it created the concept of shell shock, and you had these people in the trenches just being blown apart by machine guns in ways that they'd never even imagined before, blown apart by shells, just sitting there in trenches waiting to be killed, completely destroying all notions and myths of, glorious war on the battlefield for patriotic die for king and country kind of rhetoric. All of that was really being used and touted, and poetry was being written in the early stages of the war. Suddenly, I mean, by the end of the war, that type of rhetoric was just ridiculous. I mean, it truly changed our consciousness as human beings, and of course opened up all sorts of horrors, not only the mechanistic side of warfare that was unleashed there, but also the gases that the Germans released in the trenches and things like this. I mean, it truly changed the way that people looked at the potential for human conflict and all of these technologies. World War II obviously ends with the shock and awe to end all shock and awes. I mean, the atomic bombs, which again completely change our conception of physics, let alone, I mean, how energy, I mean, it completely transforms us societally, conscious in terms of our consciousness, in terms of the way we relate to the world. It does bring to mind the question of what World War III will unleash on the world, and what types of mechanistic horrors will be unleashed, and what types of technologies will be revealed through that conflict. Because again, I mean, the average person had no concept of splitting the atom before World War II started, but everyone knew about it in the wake of that. The average person today has very little understanding about some of the technologies that already exist for weather manipulation and whatever other kinds of crazy projects that DARPA is working on that's sitting there in the bowels of the Pentagon waiting to be used. Of course, warfare is always the excuse to unleash all of these technologies, bring them out into the open, and get people to obey their robot overlords or whatever is coming. It's a very good point, because clearly, if there is a transhumanist agenda, and I think there certainly is, World War III would be a wonderful place to unleash some of these technological nightmares that will be part of introducing this to the public consciousness.
Indeed. No, I think you're both right. And in fact, as you said, if there were a depopulation agenda, what better way than, as you said, Piers, through a world war type scenario? And something else that I wanted to mention just quickly, because on the notion of staging a conflict, orchestrating a conflict for some other ends, some economic ends, perhaps, as we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, a lot of that is driven by economics, and that Paul Krugman famously said a couple of years ago that you know, why not tell people aliens are invading? Why not create some sort of false alien invasion type scenario?
Fake war, yeah.
Right. It's in order to, you know, pump out some more dollars and get some more deficit financing going. So, I mean, there's that angle also as far as what could potentially drive a sort of manufactured crisis. I don't know, but what would result from it? You know, I shudder to think, as you said, James. I mean, what kind of horrors would be unleashed? What kind of horrors that we don't even know exist yet? That have been kept from us, or from the general public, mostly. You know, it's amazing to think.
Horror, I think, is the key word, because I think that really is. I mean, what better way can you shape or reshape a society's fundamental beliefs than through just witnessing the absolute atrocities and horrors of war and thinking anything we can do to avoid that? And how fundamentally can that transform a society? So, I mean, regardless of the veracity of Pike's letter, I mean, at the very least, the idea underneath it is that, you know, having witnessed this incredible destruction and bloodshed, the world will be ready to say, absolutely not. We do not want this ever again. You know, please save
us.
We'll
do anything. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is exactly what led to the League of Nations, which is exactly right. What led to the United Nations, which is exactly what's going to lead to whatever comes out of World War III. And it's the same mentality and psychology.
And people don't even have to think that far back. You know, our memories are short, but just think back to just, you know, what, 13 years ago after September 11th? What were Americans willing to do and to accept after that sort of shock? Imagine something on a much, much, much larger scale. What horrors will we come to accept then? Again, I started to think, but I mean, it's only logical to conclude that one would, or people would, willingly accept all manner of horrors in order to, you know, stop the next war or whatever it might be.
We cannot leave this conversation here.
No.
We have to talk about, you know, so what is this, what can we posit here? What can we say to break this cycle, break this conditioning, derail the freight train, disrupt the narrative? What can we do?
I think it's important to take a step back and to, you know, think about this logically, in the sense that I don't think that this is going to happen tomorrow. I don't think this might even happen 20 years from now, or it may never really happen in the way that we're describing this. And again, it's important to keep that in mind, because the fear mongers everywhere in the mainstream media, in the alternative media, you know, academics, politicians, they want you in this constant state of fear. And, you know, if you allow yourself to be totally and 100% consumed by this, then you either are totally willing to allow any of your freedoms and liberties to be, you know, destroyed, or you become so apathetic that you simply just don't care. And it just merely becomes a, oh, yeah, see, duh, I told you, you know, you were all sheeple, you were all, you know, asleep. you know, look what happened later, you know, let me get on with my life. And that's really a dangerous sort of path to go down. And again, I think, you know, we also need to, you know, come up with the real tangible solutions to some of this. And, you know, they could be as small as, you know, not paying your federal income tax, which mostly goes to warfare. And that doesn't seem like a big, massive kind of a thing, but that's something small that you can do, and that's something that, you know, does make a difference. I mean, the IRS wants that money, you know, they, you know, and that's a small thing. But I think, more broadly speaking, we need to kind of take a step back. We also need to live our lives. And we need to not be constantly, you know, fooled by so many different people that are willing to kind of lead us down into some sort of a trap, where suddenly, you know, we are concerned about, you know, a nuclear weapon going off in New York City, or, you know, an Ebola virus, you know, wiping out half the planet. You know, we need to kind of, you know, get outside, you know, talk to people, unplug from everything. You know, living your life is a very big part, and essentially, you know, the powers that be don't want you to live your life. They want you to live in this little tiny box and have this, you know, tiny index card of allowable thought and speech to dictate everything that you do. And any kind of resistance to that, I think, ultimately is a bullet in our chamber against them. And that's a really positive thing as well. And again, I think that so much of this World War III scenario is about programming us into a certain mindset. And if we can kind of break that programming, and if we can kind of think for ourselves, and if we can, allow ourselves not to be fooled by this, that's, you know, to the detriment of these, you know, psycho elite globalists. So, I mean, that's, you know, one small thing that we can do.
No, yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, I want to just add this, not to keep, you know, not to persist with the pessimistic tone, but I just want to add this, and I want to get your thoughts on this, James, because this is something we've touched on before, that I think that there's a delicate balance between, as you said, Pierce, living your life, because I think that's true. I think the best way to live free is to live free, is to act in that manner. However, I think it's a delicate balance between, you know, living your life and not caring about what's going on. You know, it's a tricky thing to sort of, as I said, balance out in one's own mind and in one's own life. So on that note, I'm just curious what you think about that, James. As I said, something we've talked about before with regard to the surveillance state, you know, how much should we, you know, care about what's happening? How much should we just, you know, live our lives and not succumb to it and change our behavior as a result of that knowledge? You know, it's a similar sort of dynamic. So I'm curious what you think about that, what Pierce said in that sort of sense.
Well, yeah, okay, so let's see if we can synthesize what you two are saying there, because I certainly understand what Pierce is saying in terms of, you know, living our lives based on fear and around the fear and how we can be railroaded into agendas that we don't want because we're basing ourselves around these potential future scenarios that go around in our heads. But at the same time, I mean, in 1914, millions of people found themselves, they were in a situation, there is war, and however it came about, it's happening, and you have to face that as a reality. In 1939, it happened. Millions of people suddenly found themselves in war. And it could happen again. I think that the underlying part of this that I think connects these ideas is that the one thing that we always have, we always will have, as long as we are free, independent human beings, is our consciousness. We have our consciousness that we control. And I think the most important thing that we have to maintain is our own identity, our own integrity, our own sense that we're not going to subsume our identity in rallying around the flag or rallying around whatever, you know, the disaster, whatever disaster is the flashpoint for some sort of war scenario. We have to maintain our integrity and maintain ourselves. And it's exceptionally difficult to do. I mean, back, of course, in August 1914, they founded the Order of the White Feather, persuading women to go around giving white feathers to men who refused to sign up for military service, labeling them cowards. You know, you're a coward. And I mean, the societal pressure that comes when you are in that war scenario, and suddenly it's like, if you're not going to fight these damn Ruskies, you're pretty much one of the enemy. It's going to be exceptionally intense, and it's going to be something like, as you say, I mean, a 9/11 a million times over, and we all know how strong the pressure was to just rally around the flag and bow down to the powers that shouldn't be in that scenario. It's going to be a million times more powerful in the wake of whatever they're, you know, whatever might set off a World War One or World War Three. So again, the point is, we have to commit ourselves to maintaining ourselves in that state of detachment from those types of identities that they, the things that they want us to subsume our identity in. And again, it's easy to say, maybe, or actually it wasn't so easy for me to say that, but it's difficult. It's that much more difficult to actually do, because again, it's hard to even imagine the pressure that's going to come on people to get on board. And if you don't support this war, you know, you're one of the enemy. And we have to remember that we are free individual human beings, and we do not have to rally around flags. We do not have to support wars. It doesn't mean we're against, you know, our neighbor who has been subsumed by that and who is consumed in their consciousness, but it means that we're not going to support them tacitly or in any other way. And if there is a significant number of people who do that, wars cannot function. Wars cannot function at this point. Wars cannot function without human beings. And I realize that ultimately the transhumanist agenda is to get us to that point where it doesn't matter. But right. But at least at this point, we still have ourselves. We still have our consciousness.
No, I completely agree. And if I could just, yeah. Go ahead, Pierce.
One quick thing, too. I think it also is, it is getting slightly, not a lot, but it is getting slightly more difficult for, you know, the state to implement some sort of a war. And we can see that with Syria, where, mm-hmm. I mean, it just, people simply just did not want to do it. And even regular average Joes on the street were sort of hesitant in believing the sort of official line. And you can see that now in Ukraine. I mean, yeah, you know, we've got the plane crash, but it's not as if there is this, you know, of course you get people like John McCain or Hillary Clinton, you know, the same person essentially complaining and, you know,
I've never yelling, seen them in the same room together.
Well, yeah, that way, you know, who knows what they do behind closed doors. But, you know, it is getting a little bit harder. Now, again, I think with if you had a 9/11 type scenario, yeah, you're going to get, you know, you could sway a lot of people. But I do have a little bit of confidence in that people, by and large, and you can even look at the conflict right now in Gaza because, you know, having been very much involved in what's going on there and having been to the West Bank before, I will really say that even here in New York, where it is an extremely pro-Israeli kind of a environment, a lot of people are starting to wake up to the idea that what is going on is mass slaughter. And what they're trying to do is to exterminate a whole entire region of people. And that is slowly kind of, you know, coming around, you know, to the point where you even get people like Joe Scarborough saying on MSNBC, this is not right, this is wrong. So I think there are little incremental things, and we have to just kind of keep expanding on that. And, you know, not to let these big, massive things get in our way. And, you know, it might be slow and it might be painful, but little by little, we are making significant changes. And that's just to kind of, you know, keep things positive because there's so much gloom and doom and negativity that, you know, you can get, you could just kind of wallow in it and kind of almost enjoy it on like a sick sort of a level. So I'll leave it there.
No, you know, and I think you answered the question that I was about to ask because, James, that when you were talking about how, you know, we each need to do this for ourselves to keep our identities and to not be caught up in the groupthink and the rallying around the flag and that sort of nationalistic fervor that comes with war. You know, I was going to ask, you know, well, you know, that would be easy enough for the three of us to do and the people who watch the show and who are in tune with this sort of way of thinking. But what about, you know, what about that neighbor? What about the majority of the people? But however, you know, that's a good point, Pierce, that in with that confrontation or that, you know, Obama's, you know, red line or whatever that was drawn with Syria and, you know, kicking it over to Congress and Congress saying no and the people saying no, you know, that's evidence of the tide perhaps changing with regard to our ideas and perceptions of war as a collective, at least here in the States. That's something to be hoped for, I suppose, that's beginning to shift a little bit. I also see this happening with regard to the drug war. You brought that up earlier, Pierce, that, you know, that how that affects every person on this planet practically. And that's beginning to shift as well, at least culturally, morally, the sort of cultural norms are beginning to shift a little bit there. We have states in this country legalizing marijuana, which I honestly thought would not happen in my lifetime. So that was surprising to me. And that's something also that I find some optimism in, that maybe people out there are waking up in larger numbers than I once thought. Maybe they're not all, you know, zoned out and fooled by the same old propaganda. I think in a large sense that war on terror propaganda that was working so well for so many years, that's obviously faded a bit. That doesn't have the same effect anymore. So yeah, I think there's lots to be optimistic about and hopeful for the future, that perhaps enough people are waking up to this sort of stuff and will not be fooled by the same old propaganda.
Well, that's why we're here having conversations like this. It's a small brick in the mortar of the wall that's going to create the society of the future. But hey, it's something, and it has to start somewhere. And we do have this time where we're not in that all-out war scenario. So at any rate, we can continue to build this. And of course, who's essential in doing that? Of course, it is the viewers. So I am once again going to invite all sorts of feedback in whatever form you want to give that kind of feedback. And of course, people are encouraged to, Corporate Report members are encouraged to leave comments on the Corporate Report website, or you can email any or all of us, and that will of course be in the show notes. We'll have Indeed. The contact details for everyone.
And do we have any beard related news this week, James? Or are we going to leave it there?
Oh, I totally didn't look up beard related news. Pierce, have you got anything? Any beard stories?
Gonna leave on a sort of more light note.
You can't leave it like that. Okay, I'm on Google News of all places. Beard. All right. Keanu Reeves shaved his entire beard off.
Point
from PerisHilton.com. Heller challenges Reed to beard off for Nevada's 150th. What? 150th?
Beard competition?
Anniversary, I guess. 150th birthday. All right. So Senator Dean Heller is growing a beard. That in itself is not newsworthy. Well, I would say it is. But when it is attached to a challenge to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to do the same, well, that's another issue.
Ooh.
There are beard
politicians.
Stories every single time.
I can't think of another senator that has a beard.
It is not common for politicians to have beards because, of course, it means you're hiding something. What are you hiding, Pierce? Right. All right, and on that weird note, let's end it.
Okay, then. Let's close this out. So as James said, I want to echo what he said. We encourage you guys to send in your questions or comments to each of us. And, of course, our contact information will be up in the show notes. Again, James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. I'm going to get this right this time. Pierce Redmond, Porkins Policy Review. .wordpress.com. Porkins Policy Radio is the program. Come back and check us out next time. We'll be back next month, and I'm really glad that we were able to keep the monthly schedule, at least so far. So we're trying to keep that going. Come back and join us on the Beard World Order. Thank you all for listening.
I want to say this to the television.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society.
You are free to do as we tell you.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
But we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy.
The Beard World Order.